Inspiration isn't always a matter of ghosts moving magnets around on refrigerator doors. And on Tuesday morning, I had a flash that was a beaut. It came while I was shaving and thinking about nothing more than remembering the beer for the party. And like the best inspirations, it came out of nowhere at all. I hurried into the living room, not quite running, wiping the shaving cream off my face with a towel as I went. I glanced briefly at the Tough Stuff crossword collection lying on top of my manuscript. That had been where I'd gone first, in an effort to decipher Go Down 19 and Go Down 92. Not an unreasonable starting point, but what did Tough Stuff have to do with TR-90? I'd purchased the book at Mr. Paperback in Derry, and of the 30 or so puzzles I'd completed, I'd done all but half a dozen in Derry. TR Ghosts could hardly be expected to show an interest in my Derry crossword collection. The telephone book, on the other hand. I snatched it off the dining room table. Although it covered the whole southern part of Castle County, Mauton, Harlow, and Cashwackamack as well as the TR, it was pretty thin. The first thing I did was check the white pages to see if there were at least 92. There were. The Y's and Z's finished up on page 97. This was the answer. Had to be. I got it, didn't I? I asked Bunner. This is it. Nothing. Not even a tinkle from the bell. Fuck you. What does a stuffed moose head know about a telephone book? Go down 19. I turned to page 19 of the telephone book, where the letter F was prominently showcased. I began to slip my finger down the first column, and as it went, my excitement faded. The 19th name on page 19 was Harold Fales. It meant nothing to me. There were also Feltons and Fenners, a Filkersham, and several Finneys, half a dozen Flahertys, and more Fosses than you could shake a stick at. The last name on page 19 was Framingham. It also meant nothing to me, but... Framingham. Kenneth P. I stared at that for a moment. A realization began to dawn. It had nothing to do with refrigerator messages. You're not seeing what you think you're seeing, I thought. This is like when you buy a blue Buick. You see blue Buicks everywhere, I said. Practically got to kick them out of your way. Yeah, that's it. But my hands were shaking as I turned to page 92. Here were the T's of Southern Castle County, along with a few U's like Alton Ubeck and Catherine Udell, just to round things out. I didn't bother checking the 92nd entry on the page. The phone book wasn't the key to the magnetic cross patches after all. It did, however, suggest something enormous. I closed the book, just held it in my hands for a moment, happy folks with blueberry rakes on the front cover. Then opened it at random, this time to the M's. And once you knew what you were looking for, it jumped right out at you. All those K's. Oh, there were Stevens and Johns and Marthas. There was a Meserve G and a Messier V and J House T. And yet, again and again, I saw the initial K where people had exercised their right not to list their first name in the book. There were at least 20 K initials on page 50 alone, and another dozen C initials. As for the actual names themselves, there were 12 Kenneths on this random page in the M section, including 3 Kenneth Moores and 2 Kenneth Munters. There were 4 Catherines with the C and 2 Catherines with the K. There was a Casey, a Kiana, and a Kiefer. Holy Christ, it's like fallout, I whispered. I thumbed through the book, not able to believe what I was seeing and seeing it anyway. Kenneths, Catherines, and Keiths were everywhere. I also saw Kimberly, Kim with an I, and Kim with a Y. There was Cammy, Kaya, yes, and we had thought ourselves so original, Kaya with an H, Kendra, Kayla, Kyle, K-E-I-L, and Kyle, K-Y-L-E. There was Kirby and Kirk. There was a woman named Kissy Bowden, and a man named Keto Rennie. Keto, the same name as one of Kyra's frigifator people. And everywhere, outnumbering such usually common initials as S and T and E, were those K's. My eyes danced with them. I turned to look at the clock, didn't want to stand John Starrow up at the airport, Christ no. And there was no clock there. Of course not. Old Crazy Cat had popped his peepers during a psychic event and was now residing in the trash. I gave a loud, braying laugh that scared me a little. It wasn't particularly sane. "Get hold of yourself, Mike," I said. "Take a deep breath, son." I took a breath, held it, let it out, checked the digital readout on the microwave. 8:15. Plenty of time for John. I turned back to the telephone book and began to riffle rapidly through it. I'd had a second inspiration, not a megawatt blast like the first one, but a lot more accurate, it turned out. Western Maine is a relatively isolated area. It's a little like the hill country of the border south, but there has always been at least some inflow of folks from away. Flatlanders is the term the locals use when they are feeling contemptuous. And in the last quarter of the century, it has become a popular area for active seniors who want to fish and ski their way through retirement. The phone book goes a long way towards separating the newbies from the longtime residents. Babickies, Paredes, O'Quinlans, Donahues, Smallnacks, Dvoraks, Blindermeyers, all from away. All Flatlanders. Jalberts, Meserves, Pillsburys, Spruces, Terrios, Perots, Stanchfields, Starbirds, Dubays, all from Castle County. You see what I'm saying, don't you? When you see a whole column of Bowies on page 12, you know that those folks have been around long enough to relax and really spread those Bowie genes. There were a few K initials and K names among the Paredes and the Smallnacks, but only a few. The heavy concentrations were all attached to families that had been here long enough to absorb the atmosphere, to breathe the fallout. Except it wasn't radiation exactly, yet I suddenly imagined a black headstone, taller than the tallest tree on the lake, a monolith which cast its shadow over half of Castle County. This picture was so clear and so terrible that I covered my eyes, dropping the phone book on the table. I backed away from it, shuddering. Hiding my eyes actually seemed to enhance the image further. A grave marker so enormous it blotted out the sun. TR-90 lay at its foot like a funeral bouquet or a ceremonial slain dove. Sarah Tidwell's son had drowned in Darkscore Lake, or been drowned in it. But she had marked his passing, memorialized it. I wondered if anyone else in town had ever noticed what I just had. I didn't suppose it was all that likely. When you open a telephone book, you're looking for a specific name in most cases, not reading whole pages line by line. I wondered if Joe had noticed, if she'd known that almost every longtime family in this part of the world had, in one way or another, named at least one child after Sarah Tidwell's dead son. Joe wasn't stupid. I thought she probably had. I returned to the bathroom, relathered, started again from scratch. When I finished, I went back to the phone and picked it up. I poked in three numbers, then stopped, looking out at the lake. Maddie and Kai were up and in the kitchen, both of them wearing aprons, both of them in a fine froth of excitement. There was going to be a party. They would wear pretty new summer clothes, and there would be music from Maddie's boombox CD player. Kai was helping Maddie make biscuits for strawberry snort cake, and while they were baking, mother and daughter would make salads. If I called Maddie up and said, "Pack a couple of bags, you and Kai are going to spend a week at Disney World," Maddie would assume I was joking, then tell me to hurry up and finish getting dressed so I'd be at the airport when John's plane landed. If I pressed, she'd remind me that Lindy had offered her old job back, but the offer would close in a hurry if Maddie didn't show up promptly at 2 p.m. on Friday. If I continued to press, she would just say no. Because I wasn't the only one in the zone, was I? I wasn't the only one who was really feeling it. I returned the phone to its recharging cradle, then went back into the north bedroom. By the time I'd finished dressing, my fresh shirt was already feeling wilted under the arms. It was as hot that morning as it had been for the last week, maybe even hotter. But I'd be in plenty of time to meet the plane. I had never felt less like partying, but I'd be there. Mikey on the spot, that was me. Mikey on the goddamn spot. John hadn't given me his flight number, but at Castle County Airport, such niceties are hardly necessary. This bustling hub of transport consists of three hangars and a terminal which used to be a Flying A gas station. When the light's strong on the little building's rusty north side, you can still see the shape of that winged A. There's one runway. Security is provided by Lassie, Breck Pellerin's ancient colleague, who spends her days crashed out on the linoleum floor, cocking an ear at the ceiling whenever a plane lands or takes off. I popped my head into Pellerin's office and asked him if the 10 from Boston was on time. He said 'twas, although he hoped the party I was meeting planned to either fly back out before mid-afternoon or stay the night. Bad weather was coming in, good gory, yes. What Breck Pellerin referred to as electrical weather. I knew exactly what he meant, because in my nervous system, that electricity already seemed to have arrived. I went out to the runway side of the terminal and sat on a bench advertising Cormier's Market, fly into our deli for the best meats in Maine. The sun was a silver button stuck on the eastern slope of a hot white sky. Headache weather, my mother would have called it, but the weather was due to change. I would hold on to the hope of that change as best I could. At 10 past 10, I heard a wasp whine from the south. At 10:15, some sort of twin-engine plane dropped out of the murk, flopped onto the runway, and taxied toward the terminal. There were only 4 passengers, and John Starrow was the first one off. I grinned when I saw him. I had to grin. He was wearing a black T-shirt with "We Are the Champions" printed across the front, and a pair of khaki shorts which displayed a perfect set of city shins, white and bony. He was trying to manage both a styrofoam cooler and a briefcase. I grabbed the cooler maybe 4 seconds before he could drop it and tucked it under my arm. "Mike," he cried, lifting one hand palm out. "John," I returned in much the same spirit. Evaway is the word that comes immediately to the crossword aficionado's mind, and slapped him 5. His homely, handsome face split in a grin, and I felt a little stab of guilt. Maddie had expressed no preference for John, quite the opposite, in fact, and he really hadn't solved any of her problems. DeVore had done that by topping himself before John had so much as a chance to get started on her behalf. Yet still I felt that nasty little poke. "Come on," he said. "Let's get out of this heat. You have air conditioning in your car, I presume?" "Absolutely." "What about a cassette player? You got one of those? If you do, I'll play you something that'll make you chortle." "I don't think I've ever heard that word actually used in conversation, John." The grin shone out again, and I noticed what a lot of freckles he had. Sheriff Andy's boy Opie grows up to serve at the bar. "I'm a lawyer. I use words in conversation that haven't even been invented yet. You have a tape player?" "Of course I do." I hefted the cooler. "Steaks?" "You bet. Peter Luger's. They're the best in the world. You told me." As we went into the terminal, someone said, "Michael?" It was Romeo Bissonette, the lawyer who had chaperoned me through my deposition. In one hand, he had a box wrapped in red paper and tied with a white ribbon. Beside him, just rising from one of the lumpy chairs, was a tall guy with a fringe of gray hair. He was wearing a brown suit, a blue shirt, and a string tie with a golf club on the clasp. He looked more like a farmer on auction day than the sort of guy who'd be a scream when you got a drink or two into him, but I had no doubt this was the private detective. He stepped over the comatose collie and shook hands with me. "George Kennedy, Mr. Noonan. I'm pleased to meet you. My wife has read every single book you ever wrote." Well, thank her for me. I will. I have one in the car. A hardcover. He looked shy, as so many people do when they get right to the point of asking. I wonder if you'd sign it for her at some point. I'd be delighted to, I said. Right away's best, then I won't forget. I turned to Romeo. Good to see you, Romeo. Make it Rami, he said. Good to see you, too. He held out the box. George and I clubbed together on this. We thought you deserved something nice for helping a damsel in distress. Kennedy now didn't look like a man who might be fun after a few drinks, the kind who might just take a notion to hop onto the nearest table, turn a tablecloth into a kilt, and dance. I looked at John, who gave the kind of shrug that means, hey, don't ask me. I pulled off the satin bow, slipped my finger under the scotch tape holding the paper, then looked up. I caught Rami Bissonette in the act of elbowing Kennedy. Now they were both grinning. There's nothing in here that's going to jump out at me and go booga booga, is there, guys? I asked. Absolutely not, Rami said, but his grin widened. Well, I can be as good a sport as the next guy, I guess. I unwrapped the package, opened the plain white box inside, revealed a square pad of cotton, lifted it out. I had been smiling all through this, but now I felt the smile curl up and die on my mouth. Something went twisting up my spine as well, and I think I came very close to dropping the box. It was the oxygen mask DeVore had had on his lap when he met me on the street, the one he'd snorted from occasionally as he and Roguette paced me, trying to keep me out deep enough to drown. Rami Bissonette and George Kennedy had brought it to me like the scalp of a dead enemy, and I was supposed to think it was funny. Mike? Rami asked anxiously. Mike, are you okay? It was just a joke. I blinked and saw it wasn't an oxygen mask at all. How in God's name could I have been so stupid? For one thing, it was bigger than DeVore's mask. For another, it was made of opaque rather than clear plastic. It was... I gave a tentative chuckle. Rami Bissonette looked tremendously relieved. So did Kennedy. John only looked puzzled. Funny, I said, like a rubber crutch. I pulled out the little mic from inside the mask and let it dangle. It swung back and forth on its wire, reminding me of the waggy clock's tail. What the hell is it? John asked. Park Avenue lawyer, Rami said to George, broadening his accent so it came out. Park Avenue lawyer. Ain't never seen one of those, have you, chummy? No, sir, cost not. Then he reverted to normal speak, which was sort of a relief. I've lived in Maine my whole life, and for me the amusement value of burlesque Yankee accents has worn pretty thin. It's a steno mask. The stenog keeping the record at Mike's depot was wearing one. Mike kept looking at him. It freaked me out, I said. Old guy sitting in the corner and mumbling into the mask of Zorro. Jerry Bliss freaks a lot of people out, Kennedy said. He spoke in a low rumble. He's the last one around here who wears them. He's got 10 or 11 left in his mudroom. I know, because I bought that one from him. I hope he stuck it to you, I said. I thought it would make a nice memento, Rami said. But for a second there, I thought I'd given you the box with the severed hand in it. I hate it when I mix up my gift boxes like that. What's the deal? It's been a long, hot July, I said. Put it down to that. I hung the steno mask strap over one finger, dangling it that way. Maddie said to be there by 11, John told us. We're going to drink beer and throw the frisbee around. I can do both those things quite well, George Kennedy said. Outside in the tiny parking lot, George went to a dusty Altima, rummaged in the back, and came out with a battered copy of The Red Shirt Man. Frida made me bring this one. She has the newer ones, but this is her favorite. Sorry about how it looks. She read it about 6 times. It's my favorite, too, I said, which was true, and I like to see a book with mileage. That was also true. I opened the book, looked approvingly at a smear of long-dried chocolate on the flyleaf, and then wrote, "For Frida Kennedy, whose husband was there to lend a hand. Thanks for sharing him, and thanks for reading. Mike Noonan." That was a long inscription for me. Usually I just stick to best wishes or good luck, but I wanted to make up for the curdled expression they had seen on my face when I opened their innocent little gag present. While I was scribbling, George asked me if I was working on a new novel. No, I said. Battery's currently on recharge. I handed the book back. Frida won't like that. No, but there's always Red Shirt. We'll follow you, Rami said, and a rumble came from deep in the west. It was no louder than the thunder which had rumbled on and off for the last week, but this wasn't dry thunder. We all knew it, and we all looked in that direction. Think we'll get a chance to eat before it storms? George asked me. Yeah, just about barely. I drove to the gate of the parking lot and looked right to check for traffic. When I did, I saw John looking at me thoughtfully. What? Maddie said you were writing, that's all. Book go tits up on you or something? My childhood friend was just as lively as ever, in fact, but it would never be finished. I knew that this morning, as well as I knew there was rain on the way. The boys in the basement had for some reason decided to take it back. Asking why might not be such a good idea. The answers might be unpleasant. Something. I'm not sure just what. I pulled out onto the highway, checked behind me, and saw Rami and George following in George's little Altima. America has become a country full of big men in little cars. What do you want me to listen to? If it's home karaoke, I pass. The last thing on earth I want to hear is you singing Bubba Shot the Jukebox last night. Oh, it's better than that, he said, miles better. He opened his briefcase, rooted through it, and came out with a plastic cassette box. The tape inside was marked 7/20/98, yesterday. I love this, he said. He leaned forward, turned on the radio, then popped the cassette into the player. I was hoping I'd already had my quota of nasty surprises for the morning, but I was wrong. Sorry, I just had to get rid of another call, John said from my Chevy speakers, in his smoothest, most lawyerly voice. I'd have bet $1 million that his bony shins hadn't been showing when this tape was made. There was a laugh, both smoky and grating. My stomach seized up at the sound of it. I remembered seeing her for the first time standing outside the Sunset Bar, wearing black shorts over a black tank-style swimsuit, standing there and looking like a refugee from crash diet hell. You mean you had to turn on your tape recorder, she said. And now I remembered how the water had seemed to change color when she nailed me that really good one in the back of the head. From bright orange to dark scarlet it had gone. And then I'd started drinking the lake. That's okay. Tape anything you want. John reached out suddenly and ejected the cassette. You don't need to hear this, he said. It's not substantive. I thought you'd get a kick out of her blather, but, man, you look terrible. Do you want me to drive? You're white as a fucking sheet. I can drive, I said. Go on, play it. Afterward, I'll tell you about a little adventure I had Friday night, but you're going to keep it to yourself. They don't have to know. I jerked my thumb over my shoulder at the Altima, and Maddie doesn't have to know, especially Maddie. He reached for the tape, then hesitated. You're sure? Yeah. It was just hearing her again out of the blue like that. The quality of her voice. Christ, the reproduction is good. Nothing but the best for Avery, McLean, and Bernstein. We have very strict protocols about what we can tape, by the way, if you were wondering. I wasn't. I imagine none of it's admissible in litigation anyway, is it? In certain rare cases, a judge might let a tape in, but that's not why we do it. A tape like this saved a man's life 4 years ago, right around the time I joined the firm. That guy is now in the witness protection program. Play it. He leaned forward and pushed the button. John. How is the desert, Ms. Whitmore? Whitmore. Hot. John. Arrangements progressing nicely? I know how difficult times like this can... Whitmore. You know very little, counselor. Take it from me. Can we cut the crap? John. Consider it cut. Whitmore. Have you conveyed the conditions of Mr. DeVore's will to his daughter-in-law? John. Yes, ma'am. Whitmore. Her response? John. I have none to give you now. I may have after Mr. DeVore's will has been probated, but surely you know such codicils are rarely, if ever, accepted by the courts. Whitmore. Well, if that little lady moves out of town, we'll see, won't we? John. I suppose we will. Whitmore. When is the victory party? John. Excuse me? Whitmore. Oh, please. I have 60 different appointments today, plus a boss to bury tomorrow. You're going up there to celebrate with her and her daughter, aren't you? Did you know she's invited the writer, her fuck buddy? John turned to me gleefully. Do you hear how pissed she sounds? She's trying to hide it, but she can't. It's eating her up inside. I barely heard him. I was in the zone with what she was saying. The writer, her fuck buddy. And what was under what she was saying. Some quality beneath the words. We just want to see how long you can swim, she had called out to me. John. I hardly think what I or Maddie's friends do is any of your business, Ms. Whitmore. May I respectfully suggest that you party with your friends and let Maddie DeVore party with her? Whitmore. Give him a message. Me. She was talking about me. Then I realized it was even more personal than that. She was talking to me. Her body might be on the other side of the country, but her voice and spiteful spirit were right here in the car with us. And Max DeVore's will, not the meaningless shit his lawyers had put down on paper, but his will. The old bastard was as dead as Damocles, but yes, he was definitely still seeking custody. John, give who a message, Ms. Whitmore? Whitmore, tell him he never answered Mr. DeVore's question. John, what question is that? Does her cunt suck? Whitmore, ask him. He'll know. John, if you mean Mike Noonan, you can ask him yourself. You'll see him in Castle County Probate Court this fall. Whitmore, I hardly think so. Mr. DeVore's will was made and witnessed out here. John, nevertheless, it will be probated in Maine, where he died. My heart is set on it. And when you leave Castle County the next time, Roguette, you will do so with your education in matters of the law considerably broadened. For the first time, she sounded angry, her voice rising to a reedy caw. Whitmore, if you think... John, I don't think. I know. Goodbye, Ms. Whitmore. Whitmore, you might do well to stay away from... There was a click, the hum of an open line, then a robot voice saying, 9:40 a.m., Eastern Daylight, July 20th. John punched eject, collected his tape, and stored it back in his briefcase. I hung up on her. He sounded like a man telling you about his first skydive. I actually did. She was mad, wasn't she? Wouldn't you say she was seriously pissed? Yeah. It was what he wanted to hear, but not what I really believed. Pissed, yes. Seriously pissed? Maybe not. Because Maddie's location and state of mind hadn't been her concern. Roguette had called to talk to me. To tell me she was thinking of me. To bring back memories of how it felt to tread water with the back of your head gushing blood, to freak me out, and she had succeeded. What was the question you didn't answer? John asked me. I don't know what she meant by that, I said, but I can tell you why hearing her turned me a little white in the gills, if you can be discreet, and if you want to hear. We've got 18 miles to cover, lay it on me. I told him about Friday night. I didn't clutter up my version with visions or psychic phenomena. There was just Michael Noonan out for a sunset walk along the street. I'd been standing by a birch tree which hung over the lake, watching the sun drop toward the mountains when they came up behind me. From the point where DeVore charged me with his wheelchair to the point where I finally got back onto solid ground, I stuck pretty much to the truth. When I finished, John was at first utterly silent. It was a measure of how thrown for a loop he was. Under normal circumstances, he was every bit the chatterbox Kai was. "Well," I asked, "comments? Questions?" "Lift your hair so I can see behind your ear." I did as he asked, revealing a big band-aid and a large area of swelling. John leaned forward to study it, like a little kid observing his best friend's battle scar during recess. "Holy shit," he said at last. It was my turn to say nothing. "Those two old fucks tried to drown you." I said nothing. "They tried to drown you for helping Maddie." Now I really said nothing. "And you never reported it?" "I started to," I said, then realized I'd make myself look like a whiny little asshole, and a liar, most likely. "How much do you think Osgood might know?" "About them trying to drown me? Nothing. He's just a messenger boy." A little more of that unusual quiet from John. After a few seconds of it, he reached out and touched the lump on the back of my head. "Ow!" "Sorry." A pause. "Jesus." Then he went back to Warrington's and pulled the fucking pin. "Jesus. Michael, I never would have played that tape if I'd known..." "It's all right. But don't even think of telling Maddie. I'm wearing my hair over my ear like that for a reason." "Will you ever tell her, do you think?" "I might. Someday when he's been dead long enough so we can laugh about me swimming with my clothes on." "That might be a while," he said. "Yeah, it might." We drove in silence for a bit. I could sense John groping for a way to bring the day back to jubilation and loved him for it. He leaned forward, turned on the radio, and found something loud and nasty by Guns N' Roses. "Welcome to the jungle, baby. We got fun and games." "Party till we puke," he said. "Right?" I grinned. It wasn't easy with the sound of the old woman's voice still clinging to me like light slime, but I managed. "If you insist," I said. "I do," he said, "most certainly. John, you're a good guy for a lawyer, and you're a good one for a writer." This time the grin on my face felt more natural and stayed on longer. We passed the marker reading TR-90, and as we did, the sun burned through the haze and flooded the day with light. It seemed like an omen of better times ahead until I looked into the west. There, black in the bright, I could see the thunderheads building up over the White Mountains.